So we are
addressing what I think is the most difficult theological religious issue in terms of belief, and that is evil and suffering, actually. Why bad things happen in the world, and particularly why bad things happen to what we would perceive as good people. Now, we mentioned last week that Moses was on Mount Sinai. He was communicating with God, and he asked the ultimate question of God, "Show me your ways." And according to one opinion in the Talmud, God answered him, "No man can see me and live." According to one opinion in the Talmud, even Moses was not told the answer to this question. And the other book, an entire book that deals with this question of suffering, Job, right, kind of the prototype of suffering, loses his children, gets horrible diseases, goes through terrible illness and pain. And when his friends are struggling to try and understand, what did he do wrong, why is he suffering, what's going on, God seems to quiet them all and not necessarily provide a real answer. So, yes, Irina. Well, the book of Job is introduced that the Satan, and I have a whole class on Jewish concept of evil and what is the Satan in Judaism, right? The Satan comes to God and says, "Oh, you know, your servant Job, he's so righteous." And it says in the beginning of Job, of the book, Job was righteous, right? So he says, "He's so righteous." God says, "Yeah, he's one of my stars." And the Satan says, "Well, of course he is. Everything's going well. Let's see what happens to him when things turn bad, when things are rough." Now, last week we talked about, and I gave you now the texts for these ideas we presented last week, and I'm going to go quickly through a synopsis of last week so we can move on, build on it and move on. So the first Talmudic text that we went to in Brachot 5a says if something happens, painful happens to a person, suffering comes upon them, look at your actions and see if you've done anything wrong. That's the first thing it says. And then it says, and seemingly this would be a punishment for the wrong that you've done. Then the second thing it says, if you look at your actions and you don't see anything that might explain it, so then it says, look to see whether you might have neglected the study of Torah. And Rashi, the primary commentator, says it means instead of a sin of commission you might have done by transgressing, doing something wrong, hurting someone, being immoral, whatever the case may be, maybe it's a sin of omission. In other words, you could have had the opportunity to do something good and you neglected it. Those are the first two approaches. Which are basically the same ones, saying it's a punishment. We'll talk about that in a second. The second text here that you have, and the third answer it's giving, if he did attribute it to, looked for something, an omission or commission, and still did not find these things, then let him be sure that these are sufferings of love. Which of course seems like an oxymoron, because who would love suffering? Right? And the Talmud then explains, what does it mean, sufferings of love? It's not necessarily sufferings that you love, but it says, if the Holy One, blessed be He, is pleased with a person, He crushes him with painful sufferings. In other words, God is giving the suffering because God loves you. And lest we be baffled by that, you remember what happened at the end of, near the end of the class? There's a guy sitting in the back row who kind of raised one hand. He didn't raise the other hand because he couldn't. He was born with a birth defect. And he said that the fact that he had this handicap made him into someone special. Gave him the ability to look at the world in a certain way, to appreciate certain things, to think of himself as having a special role in the world. And in fact, he said, what does he do now professionally? He works with special ed at children with special issues. So, Sometimes people who go through these sufferings view them as an asset and not a liability. View them as a gift and not as a punishment. So the book of Job, it would seem, is taking that approach. It's saying God, the Satan is not an independent force of God. The Satan is there to bring out, in this scenario, is saying let's test Job to allow him to show his true devotion. In other words, the sufferings of love would be to bring a person to a higher level, to make a person greater. To Nachmanides says a test is something that brings out the potential in a person. So that is one of the answers, and that's what the Book of Job seems to present. Okay? Yes?
The thing is, I mean, the Book of Job is somewhat problematic to me, precisely because if that were true, if the test were to bring out the higher potential, first of all, the whole concept of trying to test someone on a challenge, there's this issue of distrust. There seems to be a distrust in that Job is only doing this because they're going so well.
So is it a distrust of Job that things that he's doing all because things are going well?
Why would God listen to that type of thinking coming from a person, this kind of an examiner?
Well, it could be one of two things. Either it could be what are Job's motives, right? Or it could be it could be something else. It could be, well, Job has shown his devotion under good circumstances. Let's give him an opportunity to show his faith and his devotion under trying circumstances. In other words, it's another opportunity.
But then why not respond to Job? Why not answer him on the merits at the end of the book instead of hiding the answer? Not telling him what he was doing was supposed to be helpful to him.
It's been a long time since I studied the book of Job, and I didn't study the whole thing in depth. Mm-hmm. But the question is whether at times the book does talk about, you know, him being able to show his devotion. Mm-hmm. I think the Talmud kind of takes that approach, that his wife says, curse God and die, God forbid. And he says, no, I can't. I can curse the day of my birth, but I cannot curse God. In other words, he does come out a hero in that he retains his faith on a certain level.
What I don't understand, though, is why God doesn't explain that this was supposed to be a test instead of responding in this kind of
The Torah is not a philosophy book. I've said this before. It's not going to present abstract theology. By the very fact that the Satan comes in as a dialogue in the beginning shows you it's not abstract philosophy, it's a story. And so I believe that the beginning of the story does tell you that.
Right, okay? Yeah.
All right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's what I would say. Now, I just want to clarify this. Last week we brought this up, but there is a second aspect of suffering as an asset. The first one we talked about was sufferings of love. The second one we're talking about now is, and by the way, back to the punishment, okay? Let me just qualify this first. When we think of suffering as punishment, right, I told the story of Rav Huna that often the message that a person is sent has within it the suffering the person is sent has within it a message of what might have been going wrong. There are two types of punishment. There's retributive punishment and there's corrective punishment. Right? Retributive punishment is measure for measure. You have to get the punishment commensurate with the crime. Corrective punishment is the way a parent disciplines a child. In other words, you only punish enough so that the person gets the message to change. So suffering as punishment is not God getting back at us. So you could even view suffering as punishment as an asset in terms of a message to the person of what's going wrong and how to correct it. Okay? So the third one, as suffering as an asset, would be suffering as atonement. And here the Talmud says, even as the covenant mentioned in connection with salt, It uses salt as a metaphor for the covenant, for our relationship to God. The salt lends a sweet taste to meat. So also in the covenant mentioned in connection with suffering. So salt is called a covenant, and suffering is called a covenant with God. So too, sufferings wash away all the sins of man. So why is suffering a covenant? Because suffering can be an atonement. We talked last week about suffering, growing and learning from suffering. That would be sufferings of love. Here it could be suffering could be, now an atonement is more almost this retributive punishment. In other words, the idea is if a person transgresses and they don't do tshuva, they don't atone for it. So just the very fact of going through the pain of the circumstances is itself, in a sense, you could say it's a payback for the wrong the person did, or you could also say that the experience of suffering elevates the person above the wrong they've done, the transgression they've done. So whether the suffering has within it a message or whether it doesn't, it still has in a sense, almost a redemptive quality to it. Now, I know what this is going to say. You'll say to God, keep your sufferings and keep the atonement, right? But we don't always have such choices. Yeah.
So it basically works as a kind of restoration of balance?
Restoration of purity, of humility, of the qualities that might have been compromised through the suffering. Or in a sense, almost a... That's what I was saying. Okay. Now, we talked about a fourth approach. Sufferings as punishment, sufferings of love, sufferings as atonement. The fourth was sufferings that bring a greater reward in the world to come. And we mentioned that the Talmud says, and here you have the text, it says, the Holy One, blessed be He, brings sufferings upon the righteous in this world in order that they may inherit the future world. So, what does that mean? It means that just like a tree which is standing in a place of cleanliness, but its boughs overhang a place of uncleanness, you cut off the bough and it stands entirely in a place of cleanness. The metaphor is, a person who is a good person might have done some wrong in this world, so God pays you back in this world for the wrong you've done, so that in the next world everything is clean. So that is no longer there, in a sense, as a debt or as a transgression attributed to the person. Okay? Obviously, for this approach, you have to believe in an afterlife. And once again, you can say, okay, God, fine, keep your afterlife, but just stop doing this to me in this world. So, but it's still viewed as a reward. Okay? All right, now I'd like to move on to what we're going to really look at tonight, different than last week. So in a sense, all the contexts we looked at last week have to do with the person themselves. Wrongs they've done, atonement they needed to get, special privilege God is giving them to go through these trying moments. But now we're going to look at a whole different area where... Now the danger of those approaches is the one that comes up in the book of Job, once again. Job's friends come to him and start pointing the finger, start telling him what he did wrong. And God silences them. And the fact is, we're going to see that, according to Jewish theology, because a person goes through suffering does not necessarily mean they have done something wrong. Okay? How could that be if we just went through all these? So we're going to look at several approaches that put suffering in a larger context and kind of disassociate it from the culpability of the individual. Okay? The first one is Deuteronomy chapter 11, which happens to be the second paragraph of the Shema. So this is a fundamental declaration of belief that we say twice a day. And what the second paragraph basically tells us, if you obey my commandments, which I give you, to love God and to serve Him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will give you rain for your land at the right season, and you will be prosperous. So basically, you follow God, you get rewarded. And conversely, beware lest your heart be deceived and you turn and serve other gods and worship them. Then God's anger will blaze against you. He will shut up the skies. There will be no rain. The land will yield no produce. And you will quickly perish from the land which God gives you. In other words, now, you do good, reward. You do bad, punishment. So the glaring question is, the world doesn't seem to work like that. That's the whole premise of this lecture, is bad things happening to good people. So how do we understand this declaration of the Shema, this fundamental statement we're saying? So what the commentaries point out is that, and the English, this is why we need to start working on our Hebrew, is that the English does not translate properly. V'haya im shamoa tishma'u. If you listen, the you here is a plural you, not a singular you. If you know French or German or other languages that have full declensions, right? The difference between the you singular, in French tu, and the you plural, which is vous. So, what the commentaries explain here is this is talking on a communal level. And meaning it's saying, as a community, if you follow God's direction, then you will be rewarded. If you stray away, you will be punished. Which is basically means there is a collective punishment. Which means if most individuals are straying, and some are still righteous, what's the implication? Everyone's going to be punished together. By the way, also, a lot of the commentaries say this direct correlation on a communal level applies mainly in the land of Israel. This is talking about the skies and prosperity, right? So in Israel, on a communal level, it's saying there's a direct correlation between straying from God's path and misfortune happening.
Does that mean that there is a greater expectation of the righteous to influence the community?
Right, so very good. So what Rina in a sense is intuitively asking is, I'll bring out the question, well, how is it fair? Right, if you have someone righteous, fine, okay, the rest of the people aren't, but why should they be punished for the rest of the people? So there is a way to try and explain it, which is to say that even that righteous person, in a sense, is held accountable for the wrongs of the society. And there are numerous principles in the Torah that talk about a responsibility to rebuke others for what they might be doing wrong. Whereas if you just sit around and let, you know, your society go down the tubes and you don't speak up about it, then there's a level of responsibility there. And the Talmud even gives another statement. It says, "Kol Yisrael arevin ze v'ze." All Jews are, in a sense, intertwined, interlinked. So if that other person isn't properly fulfilling their path, then, in a sense, it affects all of us. It's all of us who are not living up to what we could be. So there's an inherent expectation that the righteous person, the good person who knows better, will try and have an impact upon the others. Okay? And they say that's the difference between Abraham and Noah. Noah, it says, went with God. Said he walked with God. He was a godly person. But his whole generation was destroyed. But Abraham, it says, God says, who walked before me. What does it mean Abraham walked before God? It means he, in a sense, was one step ahead. He was trying to do God's work and bring God into the world and to everyone else instead of just sitting back and saying, okay, I got my act together, I'm okay. And Noah, in fact, did succeed in saving himself. But only himself and not the rest of the world. And we see that after he comes out of the ark, what happens? He gets drunk, he's in this state of brokenness, perhaps because of a feeling of, well, you know, maybe he did think, what did I do to try and stop this? Okay? Yeah.
Actually, I can see why that even would be fair, because you would think that people who are righteous, they have achieved some kind of great level of understanding, and when you grow, your probably responsibilities become higher, than, yeah. And you can't adhere
with
to
the great system. Power comes great responsibility. Okay. In the words of Uncle Ben, I think, right? Sorry? Wasn't Ben? Wasn't that his uncle? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's what it's saying, exactly. So the first principle is collective punishment. Okay? And by the way, also, collective works not just across community, but we even view it in a sense, we're going to have to deal with this the next one, is there collective punishment across generations? Because we say, we ask God in the beginning of our prayer, remember the merits of our ancestors. And we believe we have a joint bank account. Okay? Our ancestors saved up the mitzvah points, and we're still going on their kind of, on their balance. So the question is, what about conversely? If there were wrongs done, can children be punished for the wrongs of their parents? So we're talking about communal punishment not across space, but across time. Yeah, Faina first.
My question is, what exactly is expected of all of us as a collective group to, I guess, prevent punishment?
What's expected of us is not just to worry about our own spiritual well-being, but worry about the spiritual well-being of those around us.
So it's not following Torah. That's not what they're saying here. It's not.
Says pretty explicitly right here. Read the text again. It says, if you follow, obey my commandments.
Okay, so follow the Torah to the T, that's what it's expected.
So what does to the T mean? We've talked about this before. The responsibility of a person is to try and grow.
Just try.
So it means to try and see what is the next step I can take. How can I prove myself? How can I get along with others? How can I be a better person? How can I elevate myself spiritually? Okay. And the step after that, you'll worry, step number two, you'll worry about after you do step number one. Your step number 20, you'll worry about when you do step number 19. Okay? They say it's not where you are on the ladder, it's what direction you're going. So that's the expectation. Okay? We also believe God is merciful, God knows where we're coming from. Okay? But following means growing. Okay? Yeah. What is your name?
Esther.
Esther. I'm saying that possibly, and then he's lying in his tent and he's uncovered and one of his sons sees him and kind of makes, at least goes and publicizes what their father did, and then the other two brothers come and cover him, and then Noah, God curses the son of the grandson, the son of the son who kind of announced that what their father had done. So, and it says he went with God, so he was a righteous person.
He was a righteous
but
person.
The implication is he could have done more.
Right. He could have saved other people, but he didn't. So, how does that work out in the end? You could either obey God's orders and you can do what you feel is right. And does God, what God says, does that necessarily mean that it's right? He said not to save anybody else.
No, God did not say tell him not to save anybody else, necessarily. That's only who, I don't know.
I mean, again, I don't know the story.
All we know is that, because God said, take you and your family and bring them on the ark. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, God didn't say, Noah, get everyone else.
He didn't say that.
But, no, that's not what, the verses do not say that, but the rabbinic teaching tells us that people would come up and say, Noah, what are you doing? He said, I'm building an ark. And he said, why? He said, oh, the flood's coming, the destruction's coming. And they just laughed at him. Now, did he not explain it well enough? Did he not try, you know? But the implication is he was with God. Abraham walked before God. So Abraham tried to proactively transform the world around him. Noah, if someone walked up to him, he would answer them. But he wasn't trying to go and tell people, warn people, or get them to change. So, does that answer your question? Yeah. That's the implication. I'm saying that perhaps what happens to him after is his realization that, you know, maybe I could have done more. So, there's an expression that was used in Europe called tzaddik in pelts. Tzaddik is a righteous person. Pelts literally means a fur. Rabbis used to wear, you know, in Russia and Poland is very cold. So they would wear a coat, it was like a wool coat, and it would be lined with fur. So the implication is, you know, oh, I'm keeping myself warm. You know, which means I'm insulated, I'm okay, but what are you doing about, you know, everyone else, keeping them warm? So that's kind of like this idea of someone just kind of worrying about themselves. So that's the implication of, you know, communal responsibility. Okay. Okay. Now, what about across generations, let alone across time? So, the Talmud presents us with two conflicting texts. The first one, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, is actually in the Ten Commandments. In the second commandment of not worshipping idols, and it says God visits the transgressions of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation. In other words, it implies that the children will be punished for what the parents do. And then it says, but he remembers the goodness, the good deeds to the thousandth generation. Which the commentaries point out, you know, you're, you know, what is it, 200 times better off, you know, with the odds are definitely in your favor, but nevertheless, how could it be that God would cause the children to be punished for what their parents did? But the implication is that so something wrong happens, maybe it's nothing I did, maybe it's something that was done in the past, which isn't very reassuring, except to say that, well, at least I'm not looking, I don't have to look at myself to see if I'm culpable. So, but the Talmud then says, but there's another verse that says, neither shall the children be put to death for the fathers. In other words, saying, children are not punished for the wrongs of their parents. So we seem to have a contradiction in good Talmudic form. Okay? And a contradiction was pointed out between these two verses, and the answer was given that there is no contradiction. One verse deals with children. This is a tone you have to say it in, right? The Talmud sing song. One verse deals with children who continue in the same course as their fathers. The other verse, with children who do not continue in the course of their fathers. So what does that mean? It means this. It means that if children continue to perpetuate the transgressions of the parents, then God will pay forward to the third and fourth generation. Now, kind of doesn't make sense because, well, if God is like, if God punished the parents, why does he need to punish the children? So this is the way the commentaries explain it. They say God will put off punishing. He'll hold back. We say God is long-suffering. God is merciful. God gives us time to repent. God will put off the punishment for 3 to 4 generations. But if the third to fourth generation continues, then they will kind of receive the cumulative effect of all that punishment that's been put off. So it kind of builds up, and then the floodgates open, and then you're really in trouble, which means that the fourth generation might be paid, might be worse off, they might have some misfortune come upon them, which is above and beyond what the wrong that they have done. Why? Because once again, it was put off for 3 to 4 generations. So this doesn't say that a person could be completely innocent and have misfortune happen because of something their grandparents did. It means they continued the wrong of that was being done, and as a result, because it was cumulative, they got in a sense, got it worse than they otherwise would have. Yes?
It seems to me, maybe I'm just being pessimistic, but most people are always doing something wrong.
Most people are always doing something wrong.
And usually...
You're really a little too much by yourself here.
Well...
Well, what I'm saying is, like, it seems to me that, like, that people are constantly continuing to do the same thing and not doing...
So there are two parts to your statement. The first one is, maybe we will have a class about what is the Jewish conception of human nature. Are we inherently good? Are we inherently bad? And that's understanding the concept of a Yetzer Hara, a negative drive within us. So we'll address that, maybe even in 2 weeks, okay? And 2 weeks is Hanukkah, and then we're off. Maybe in January when we come back, we'll address that, right? What is the nature of the human being, okay? But it basically, yes, Judaism recognizes that human beings are flawed and make mistakes. That's why we say God is merciful and long-suffering. He will put off punishment. He will give us a chance to make up, to get our act back together again. Okay? The second part to that question is, you know, and this you find very tragically in terms of abuse, is often people who are abused as children will perpetuate that upon their children. Often. But we still have to say that every generation has free will. And people can choose to not perpetuate the mistakes that happened before.
The problem is they didn't seem to do that.
Sorry?
They didn't seem to do that, and that seemed kind of never ending.
Who's they?
They meaning most people.
I don't know. I mean, when I was growing up, my parents didn't get along, and I said, you know, I am resolved that I am going to hopefully marry the person who I'll get along with. And thank God. Whereas you could say some people, you know, they see dysfunctionality and perpetuates. So one would hope to think that people, that we believe in free will and people have the ability to step back, look at themselves and their lives and what they're from, and to say, I can do something about it. But we'll have a whole, that's really a question of free will, the nature of man, okay, and change. Okay, so once again, suffering because of one's family doesn't mean that one is completely innocent. It means one might be perpetuating the wrongs that came before, and then look, where there's a systemic fault of the Jewish people, we say that the temple was destroyed because of needless hatred. Our people, there are hundreds of thousands died in the Roman siege of Jerusalem. The temple was destroyed. Jews were scattered throughout the world, and you just have to come to the history class to hear 1,000 years of European history, the suffering that it brought about. So you'd say, well, why is it fair that the European Jews suffered for what Jews did 1,000 years before? How can that be fair? Or is it just simply God visiting upon the descendants that which their ancestors did? Right? So there's an idea that the rabbis say this, they said every generation that the temple is not rebuilt, it's as if it had been destroyed. Which means what? Which means that we are still perpetuating the same wrongs that was done before that brought about the destruction of Jerusalem, which was needless hatred. In other words, we still have that. And if we would clean up our act, then things would change. How would they change? You know, we're still not all in Israel, and the temple's there, and there's a mosque. If we ultimately view a spiritual view of the world, if we would change, God would figure out how to, the logistics. Okay, our job is not, we believe our job is to be engaged politically and is to make efforts, but ultimately we believe the ultimate causes for these realpolitik situations are not political ones, or economic ones. They are spiritual ones. Okay. All right. Now, the next one is, this is going to blow you away. Because, and by the way, Truth in Advertising, on the email I said we would try and deal with this terrible, horrible tragedy in Mumbai. I mean, you look at this rabbi and his wife, and we probably have all met these Chabad Shluchim. They're like the sweetest of people. You know, and then you look at this other rabbi who went, he was helping his friend who was a rabbinic supervisor. They needed two guys. They didn't want to be alone, so he was traveling. He helped his friend out to go and travel with them, leaving his, you know, his wife and family behind. And how do we understand this? You know, how can you say that, well, you know, they had it coming to them? They did something wrong? Have this terrible, terrible horror. So, I just got an email that, I don't know, it's pun. They say that there might have even been some torturing before they were killed. Horrible stuff. We know the wife was, now we know 6 months pregnant. Horrible, horrible stuff. So how do we understand this? So, next week we're going to talk about the Holocaust, responses to the Holocaust. And this will relate to it. Okay? And this is suffering as victim of wickedness, of evil. Okay? This is from a commentary, the Ora Chaim, who is a 16th century Moroccan rabbi who moved to Israel. If you go to the Old City of Jerusalem, right as you come down, you enter in Jaffa Gate and you go down into the Jewish quarter on the right, there's the old Yeshuv Court Museum, which is actually also has the Ora Chaim Synagogue in it. That's where the synagogue was that he established when he came to Israel. So, in his commentary, he says this. The context is, in the book of Genesis, Reuven is trying to save Joseph. So what does he say to the brothers? He says, let's not kill... The brothers say, oh, you know, here comes Joseph. Remember, Joseph had these dreams of megalomania. He's going to rule over his brothers. The brothers viewed him as a danger. He was telling on them to their father, trying to turn their father against him. So his brother coming and say, oh, let's do him in. And we'll see, you know, what his dreams are. He had these dreams of ruling over us. He's going to die and nothing's going to happen. So Reuven says, do not kill, let's not touch him, do not actively put a hand on him, throw him into a pit. And we're actually told that, you know, in the pit there were snakes and scorpions, or at least if you leave them overnight in a pit in the desert, there were lions in the desert. He's going to be in equal danger. Why leave him to die a slow or maybe horrible death? Maybe we'd have been better off just end it right there quick. So why did Reuven say that? Because this is what the Orchan says. Because human beings have free will, and they're able to kill someone who is not decreed to die. In other words, if someone is killed like this, tragically, doesn't mean, they were supposed to die, they must have done something wrong, and this person who's killing them is just an agent to bring about their death. What it says is, but that's not so. That they are able to kill someone who is not decreed to die, which is not the case for wild animals which do not attack a person unless it is decreed in heaven that they are to die. In other words, because animals are part of nature, and if we believe God's running the world, if an animal attacks a person and kills them, that person, their time has come. This was their time to leave. But it's saying that if a person died at the hand of evil, like these terrorists in Mumbai, that they might have been totally innocent. This had nothing to do with, they weren't supposed to leave this world. Their lives were cut off prematurely. Why? Because of these evil people. In other words, and why these evil people? So this is another different philosophical issue, which we can talk about in the future. But this is, in a sense, part of the deal of God giving human beings free will. If God gives people free will, He gives us the opportunity to elevate ourselves and to become great. And we're rewarded for it because we accomplish that. But on the other hand, He has to give us the opportunity to mess up. So, what it means is that evil person used their free will and killed this person who was not meant to be taken from this world. Yes, Paul, you had a question.
I'm just looking at this in comparison between human beings and wild animals in terms of free will. Does this have any connection with the fact that human beings have a soul and animals don't?
Yes, definitely. Human beings have a soul. Part of that soul is choosing whether to follow a divine path or, God forbid, the opposite. So that's why Reuven says, throw him into the pit. Because if you throw him in the pit, it's under God's jurisdiction. And if he's not meant to die, God will save him from the animals. They won't kill him. Whereas on the other hand, he's saying, if you leave him, if I leave him in the hands of these, my brothers, they might choose to kill him, and God cannot prevent that. So here you have a position that the person is completely not culpable for the wrong that is perpetuated. Now, the interesting question, which I don't have an absolute answer for, if you know, you're thinking about Mumbai, actually, it's interesting. What about the tsunami? Okay? Killed hundreds of thousands of people. Does that enter the category of like a wild beast, kind of an act of nature, that God does control, and therefore the people dying were meant to be taken at that moment? You see the implication of it? Anything that is not human free will is under God's jurisdiction, and God then orchestrated it. So let's look at the next text. This is from the Talmud. The context is, on the night of Passover in Egypt, God specifically tells Moses to tell the people, do not walk out of your homes. Do not leave your home. Why? Why not leave their home? So you saw the Cecil B. DeMille, the movie, right? The Jews put the marker with the blood on the doors, and therefore the angel of death saw that and turned away. Right? Well, maybe, maybe not. The angel of death would know who's Jewish, whether it's on markers on the door or not. Right? So, why wouldn't the angel of death just be able to distinguish between a person, you know, whether they're Jewish in the home with the marker or whether they're outside? So here it says, text number 6, Rav Joseph learned, what is the meaning of the verse? And none of you shall go out of the door in his house until the morning. Once permission has been granted to the destroyer, he does not distinguish between righteous and wicked. Okay, once permission has been granted to the destroyer, he does not distinguish between righteous and wicked. The implication is, kind of back to what we talked about before of collective punishment, except collective punishment before we were saying the good person had a responsibility to turn everyone around. Here it's kind of implying something different. It's saying that maybe on a certain level there was this catastrophe that was supposed to happen. Maybe there are certain people who were liable. But once they're being taken out, the righteous person, you know, wrong place, wrong time, might be taken with them. Not because of any culpability, just because apparently once that force is in the world, it's kind of given free rein. Okay, so that would be saying, well, the tsunami was meant to happen. There was certain reasons for it, but it doesn't necessarily mean each and every person who was taken is liable. By the way, I know, you know, next week we're doing responses to the Holocaust. Obviously, you'll see how we're going to have to take a lot of these principles and then try and struggle with them and see how, what does this mean in the context. Once again, not speaking abstractly. At the beginning of last week's class, they said, you know, we're going to be philosophizing about evil and suffering, which in a sense, are we allowed to do it out of context? Once you bring in the Holocaust, which is so much closer to us, and so devastating in magnitude, and maybe some of us, like myself, who might have had parents or grandparents in it, then it's no longer an abstract question. It's something real that's right there confronting us. And of course, it's going to engage us in a way that maybe the abstract wouldn't, okay? So, and by the way, then it says below, I will cut off you, the righteous and the wicked. So the Talmud says, why does it say I'll cut off the righteous and then the wicked? If we just said this is happening to get rid of the wicked and the righteous unfortunately are taken with them. So it says the righteous are taken first before the wicked. Why? So they won't have to see the outcome of the destruction. And there was a great rabbi who lived in the early 20th century, the Chafetz Chaim. He passed away in the 1930s. And he actually had a premonition of what was coming, and almost mercifully, some point to the Talmud, he was taken before he had to see that terrible destruction. So, I hope this has given us some tools. Next week we'll talk about responses to the Holocaust. I'm not giving you answers, but we will confront the reality of it. And actually, interestingly enough, tonight in our Jewish history series, we're up to the Holocaust and the birth of the State of Israel. So we'll get the historical background, and then next week we'll deal with the theological question. Yes?
I hope I asked this question correctly, but it seems to me that, you know, why do we suffer? A lot of it has to do with what, you know, how we're responsible for our actions, and then how we're responsible for our, you know, our ancestors' actions, and as a, you know, as a collective
community,
group.
Yeah.
So I have to wonder, why are the Jewish people suffering, it seems, more than any other group? Are we sinning more than any other group? Am I wrong that we are suffering?
So that will be for our discussion on anti-Semitism and the reason for anti-Semitism. But remember, there's also a category here to say we suffer because evil people perpetuate suffering. So is there something about us that makes us more of a target? That might be the question then. Okay? And remember, we are the people that brought the sense of morality to the world. I guess give you a little preview. What did Hitler say? He said the Jews have given the world two scourges, circumcision and conscience. In other words, circumcision was kind of that Greco view of, you know, the body of the temple, right? The body is temple, defacing the body, which they viewed as a perversion, we view as a perfection. The body doesn't have an inherent perfection to it until we work on it. And conscience is that people who represent immorality will naturally draw as their first target the people who are speaking an opposite philosophy and who have given that opposite philosophy to the world. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I don't want to spill all the beans, but we'll have an entire session on the reasons for anti-Semitism.
The question I have is why fear Hashem? But let me sort of phrase it for a second.
Why
fear Hashem? And one of the commands is to fear Hashem, but let me phrase the question slightly differently. The title of the class is Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And especially reflecting on last week's class, it really seemed like the bad things are actually good things. It seems that, one, we don't really recognize how it helps us, or two, it's to help us improve, or three, it's a way for us to build character. So while we think it's a bad thing, it's not really a bad thing. It's always in our benefit in one of those three categories. If that's the case, how can we fear Hashem if everything he's doing for us is ultimately one of these three ways?
The question is, if ultimately the suffering has a purpose to it and is even something that might be good for us, so why are we meant to fear Hashem? You mean fear of punishment? Like, why should I be afraid for God to punish me? Because it's saying that, you know, because if we get the message before we need the patch, so to speak, then isn't that better? In other words, if I know that if I don't improve myself, I'm going to get a message which is going to be a painful one, which will get me to change. So I'll say, okay, let me figure it out before I have to get to that point.
Okay, so the anticipation of the punishment ultimately allows you to improve before you need the punishment.
Before you need it, ideally, hopefully. Yeah. Okay. Can speak to me afterwards if there are more questions. We're going to take a short break and then start the Berlin series on Jewish history. We're up to our sixth session installment, which is going to be Zionism, the Holocaust and the birth of the State of Israel. So stay tuned.